and we move to the fourth case for today, United States versus Seeley.
May it please the court, my name is Chris Kelly. I represent Robert Seeley in this challenge to his sentence. Mr. Seeley was sentenced pursuant to 18 U.S.C. 3553B before the Supreme Court excised that sentencing provision from federal law. He was sentenced pursuant to a sentencing regime that the Supreme Court found unconstitutional in Booker. The court in his case enhanced his guideline maximum on the basis of facts that the judge found at sentencing, and that is exactly the situation that the Supreme Court told us in the Booker case constitutes an illegal and unconstitutionally imposed sentence. It's our position that Mr. Seeley is entitled to a sentence that is imposed in a manner that is consistent with the Constitution and that is consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Booker. He is entitled to a sentence in which the guidelines are considered, but in which all of the other factors in 3553A are considered as well, and he is entitled to a sentence that, as 3553A tells us, is sufficient but not greater than necessary to meet the goals of sentencing. We don't know what the district court would have done if the district court had sentenced Mr. Seeley under that regime. It is for that reason that it's appropriate to remand this case for resentencing so that the court has the opportunity to exercise the discretion that it now has. And that's the remedy that we're asking this court to impose. I think that's also the remedy that's required by 3742F1, which instructs this court to remand for further sentencing if the sentence was imposed in violation of the law. And there is no doubt that this sentence was imposed in violation of Mr. Seeley's Sixth Amendment rights.
This sounds like an all or nothing kind of an argument. And maybe I'm mishearing it, but your position then is that every Booker violation is plain error?
I don't know that I would go so far as to say every Booker violation is plain error. There may be a situation, for instance, in which a defendant was sentenced at a mandatory minimum, so there's no lower that a judge can go. And I think if a remand wouldn't accomplish anything, then there doesn't need to be a remand. Other than that, I think most cases do need to be remanded for resentencing because at least those cases that are in this posture, pre-Supreme Court Booker cases or pre-Seventh Circuit Booker cases for that matter, yes, because those are cases in which defendants were sentenced pursuant to a regime that the Supreme Court said is unconstitutional and in which defendants didn't have any incentive to bring forward a lot of mitigating evidence that the guidelines told judges not to consider because there was no point in doing it.
Well, you had the opportunity to bring forward that evidence for purposes of persuading the judge to plot the defendant within the range in a certain way that was favorable to him, right?
Well, except for all of the factors that the guidelines say judges can't consider.
Your point must be that there's a distinction between the discretion the judge had inside a guideline range.
Certainly.
Which that was not a reviewable choice, so you couldn't get appellate review on what motivated the judge to choose a particular point within a range. But just because you couldn't get appellate review didn't mean that the judge, for example, was supposed to use race, you know, to pick somebody at the low end versus the high end of a range, or for that matter, charitable activities or all those other things I was just reading off. So the judges were constrained by the law, even though there was a rather strict review mechanism.
That's very true. And it's also true that judges were constrained by the guideline itself. In Mr. Seeley's case, the judge was looking at an 87 to 108 range, a very narrow range, as all ranges are. If the judge had been looking at what the true range is, which is 5 years to 40 years, we don't know what the judge would have done, and that's why it's important to remand. I don't want to eat into my co-counsel's time. So
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Ronald Benavides. I represent Eduardo Ruiz Hernandez. I apologize for my voice this morning. Very briefly, I would point out that there's a narrow question as far as Ruiz Hernandez, but it's in the context of, in particular, the Booker case, including the one promulgated by this court, in that despite the fact that he agreed to the reduction of quantities at the sentencing, there's reference in the record to a reduction from 6.1 to 5.28 kilograms. He did so without being fully informed in the context of Booker. And so it does go to due process argument in the sense of he has the right to be fully informed when he makes a decision about entering an objection. And I would put it this way, where he places his argument at sentencing. There's reference in this record to his arguing once the range was achieved, he did argue some of those factors, such as age, lack of prior record, and so on. But that's clearly in the context of the guidelines, that the structure of the guidelines, where that's the only place it applied.
Now, of course, in the post-Booker world, what the guidelines refer to in 1B1.3 as relevant conduct is still presumably going to be one of the things both prosecutors and defense will be discussing, right? That's how he got up to the 5.28 kilograms.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. But in terms of the placement of his argument, I would put it that way, where, in other words, in a world where the court is considering those formally prohibited factors under 5H1, those would be placed differently, and that is reflected in the concept of his uninformed decision, uninformed as to when he makes an objection, and as an inference from that, uninformed as to how he places his argument. So in a nutshell, he's asserting that there is error, it's plain, it affects his substantial rights, and that that calls into question the fairness, integrity, and public reputation of the proceedings in that the sentence is based on something that's unconstitutional. In a nutshell, that's my argument. I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Laura Shabalinsky-Finn. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the Western District of Wisconsin. I was counsel at the district court level and handled the appeal, and here today to answer to Mr. Kelly and Mr. Benavides on this plain error issue. We do believe that it is plain error review, and I know this Court has heard arguments over and over and over in the last week and a half, so I'd like to just hit on some points that you all have made today. One of the first points I'd like to hit on is the question on whether or not the Fourth Circuit has it right in Hughes. Just remand all of these and be done with it and find out what the courts would have done. The problem with Hughes is that their analysis is flawed. Hughes was based on the fact that at the time of the sentencing, the judge found facts that a jury should have found beyond a reasonable doubt. That's simply not the standard. Under Booker, the Supreme Court's decision in Booker, nothing has changed in terms of how facts are found. They're still found by a preponderance of the evidence. They're still found by a district court judge. As Judge Easterbrook stated in McReynolds, the question is one of flexibility. So that's what we have to focus in on. Once the judge views the guidelines as discretionary as opposed to mandatory, or as advisory as opposed to mandatory, does anything change? And in this particular case, Judge Shabazz made a number of statements on the record to suggest that nothing would change.
So what's the harm of just asking him? It would take him 5 minutes, if that's really what he thinks, to say, even though my analysis was constrained by the structure of the guidelines, I'm satisfied based on the experience the commission brought to the calculation of the guidelines themselves, blah, 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 and the facts of this record, that this was a sentence I would have imposed in the post-Booker world. Then we know.
And I think that's tempting in these Booker cases. I think the problem with it, though, is it sets a precedent for all plain error analysis from this day forward in all kinds of cases.
But don't you think Booker cases are a little different in that there's a wide range of discretion for sentences? A lot of cases, take the post-Apprendi cases, for example, where the only question was, could you find plain error in the failure let's say, to ask the jury whether more than 5 kilos of cocaine was involved. And the record overwhelmingly shows, you know, that there are hundreds of kilos of cocaine. So you get kind of a binary choice. There's a higher statutory maximum now, and you can be quite confident that no one would have found otherwise. Whereas this month-by-month-by-month analysis of the guidelines is a different kind of inquiry.
It is, but I think we go back to what would we be faced with once we got back to the district court. I mean, the Supreme Court in Booker still said, look, you do the same thing. The only thing that's different is the guidelines are advisory. But even in Crosby, the Second Circuit pointed out that these are not casual, this isn't casual advice, these guidelines. This is something that the district court has to take seriously and consider seriously. And it's not the whim of a district judge to say, you know what, yeah, these are fine, but no, I don't think so. I mean, then we'd be arguing, look, the sentence is unreasonable if the judge swayed too far from the guidelines.
We're expecting those appeals down the line.
And I'm sure they will come. In this particular case, though, on these facts, Judge Shabazz did sentence at the middle of the range and at the high end of the range. And the defense attorneys did argue that these guys were young, that they didn't have much of a criminal history. They urged the court that in Seeley's case, 87 months was plenty of time to satisfy the requirements of 3553A. And that's the other point. 3553A was always there. The judge always had to look at these things. The judge always had to look whether there was
Then you also come up against, as Judge Wood mentioned, 5H1.11, prior military service, civic and charitable, public service, employment-related contributions, and so forth. Couldn't be considered.
Right.
However, not ordinarily relevant in determining whether a sentence should be outside the applicable guideline range.
And that's the point here. We've got a huge guideline range that the judge can choose from. Mr. Seeley submitted tons of letters from family and everybody else. The judge could have said, you know what, he is young. He made a mistake. This is unfortunate. 87 months is, frankly, enough for anybody to be, you know, in prison if you didn't kill somebody. So that's what I'm going to do. That's not what he said. What he said was that Mr. Seeley had a drug problem. He was in the conspiracy for a long time. He sold lots of cocaine. There's a significant risk of recidivism. I need to sentence him to protect the community, provide treatment for him, provide vocational training. That's straight out of 3553A. The judge looked at those things. He considered them against the fact that Mr. Seeley had a young daughter, that he was living with the mother of that child. All those other things were in the mix. They just weren't they just didn't sway him. They just didn't sway him that 87 months was enough, and his attorney argued that it should be. Same with Mr. Ruiz Hernandez. There was an argument that he's young, that he was only involved for a short time, that he should get a sentence at the low end. Again, isn't 97 months plenty of time for anyone? Judge Shabazz says, you know what, not in this case, no. So he had the opportunity to go lower. He didn't. And if we're going to really conduct a plain error review, it's up to this court to determine whether on this record somebody's substantial rights were affected. And then beyond that, if they were, which I submit they were not in this case, whether there's a miscarriage of justice.
But, of course, in Ruiz Hernandez's case, his range, as I recall, is 97 to 121. The judge picks a number basically in the middle. If the judge had thought the relevant range, you know, was 80 to 121, the midpoint would have been different. You know, and judges sometimes think relativistically about these ranges. I'm going to go low end, high end, midpoint, and it's the starting point that the guidelines created, which might lead to a different endpoint without those strictures.
That would be true if the guidelines were completely thrown out, but they're still a factor to be considered. This range is still going to be presented to the judge as the thing that is going to make sentences across the board common, that the same kinds of people are going to get the same kinds of sentences for the same crimes.
Do you really think so, or do you think that they're systematically going to go up in white-collar cases where the guidelines tend to be quite lenient, you know, antitrust defendants who squander millions of dollars of other people's money don't wind up spending much time in prison, and drug defendants such as these two wind up with colossally long sentences. You think there may be some leavening of both of those extremes?
If what's happened since Booker in the Seventh Circuit and the advisory or the alternate sentences that our judges are imposing, I don't think there's going to be a huge difference. Now, that's not in the record. That's just my opinion, but I don't think there is. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Kelly.
I think what the government fails to appreciate is that judges weigh facts differently depending upon the kind of discretion that they have, and that the judge in Mr. Seeley's case might decide to reweigh the facts, or his defense lawyer may decide to present more mitigating facts simply because the judge has more discretion to consider those facts at this point.
I have a question about that. As you know, Mr. Kelly, I'm a creature of the state court system,
yes,
where sentencing discretion is pretty much wide open, and attorneys don't hold back argument on mitigating factors as a result. And,
right.
And you seem to be telling us that that is, in fact, what defense attorneys do in the federal system by virtue of how the guidelines, as a practical and legal matter, operate, that they hold back on arguing mitigating factors, even though that may make a difference as to where the defendant is plotted within the applicable range. And that doesn't make sense to me.
Well, it may not make sense, but that's what we do. I do practice in both federal and state courts, and I make a very different sentencing argument in state court than I make in federal court, or at least I did before. I'm now going to make them the same way. And the reason for the difference is that the guidelines were controlling in federal court. In front of this judge in particular, it was likely that the judge would take a look at what the range was based on drug quantity, which in this case was a range of 3.5 to 5 kilograms, produce this sentencing range. Then he'd look at the drug quantity and say it's 4.5. That's close to the top end of the guideline range. Therefore, I'm going to give him a sentence that's close to the top end of the guideline range. And so we ended up arguing about what the guideline range should be because that was perceived as being the controlling fact. And we didn't put the focus on mitigating evidence that could persuade a judge to go considerably lower because we didn't think it was going to make a difference. Because we knew where the judge was what facts the judge was going to weigh more heavily. Now that the judge is able to weigh any mitigating fact that the judge thinks is relevant and appropriate, we're going to focus our sentencing efforts very differently than we did before. And I think that's why these cases all need to be remanded. Or at least this one does. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Your Honors. Very briefly, I would pose this language to you, that in the pre-Booker world, the sentencing judge dealt with the sentencing according to a structure and was somewhat tied into that particular structure, that is, what he considered and when he considered it. And now that structure, I would assert, is loosened up a bit so that these mitigating factors can be considered in a different way and that they could well make a difference. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to counsel again. The case will be taken under advisement.